welcome for the conference, which I am delighted to do. I think this conference is actually representative import here at the Institute. When you look at the people who have organized it and you look at aspects of the subject material, I think it's quite fitting that it's here. In terms of the people who organized it and, of course, their scientific involvement in the material, with Andrei Staronets, who, of course, is a postdoc here. I think he's still a postdoc here, right? He's officially still a postdoc. Alex Richel, who's an associate with the University of Western Ontario, and Valery Baranski, who's an affiliate. All the organizers, of course, have had a long-standing scientific involvement in the Institute. And in terms of the subject matter itself, in terms of the ability to find phenomenological relevance with string theory and string theoretic techniques, that's also an aspect of the core value of this Institute, to be trying to establish a balance between more formal and phenomenological approaches. So it gives me particular satisfaction to welcome all of you here in this building. For many of you, I see this is not your first time. Some of you, I'm sure it is. You're all welcome to stay, not just amongst your colleagues, but talk to other people at the Institute, enjoy the bistro, the atmosphere, obviously the scientific atmosphere with your colleagues. Have a wonderful conference, and enjoy.
So we will start with Professor Arnauri, who will have a lot more information. You have one hour in the
program. Right, thanks. Good morning. As I understand my role here, I'm supposed to replace the experimentalists. And so I will try to give you an overview, a phenomenological overview, of course, with the eye of a theoretician, on what Rick has produced. The first line of the title is a quote from a cup that you get when you give a talk at Brookhaven. Rick serves the perfect fluid. So I will discuss what experimental evidence and theoretical interpretation this statement is based. And I called my talk Successes and Puzzles from 5 years of Rick experiments. The people at the bottom are the people who have contributed to various aspects of these talks. The red ones are the graduate students that have done most of the works. Purple are postdocs, and green are outside collaborators. So the goal of heavy ion physics at Rick and the LHC is ambitious. We want to recreate the matter that fills in the universe for the first few microseconds. And we are trying to do that by colliding large atomic nuclei onto each other at high energies. At Rick, it's 100 GeV per nucleon, gold on gold nuclei. And roughly what happens in such a condition is that these two very highly excited, therefore Lorentz contracted along the direction of their motion, nuclei look like pancakes. They collide with each other. In the first initial hard collisions, you produce a few high PT particles. Then subsequently you produce lots and lots of low PT particles which interact with each other and thermalize, forming what is called a quark-gluon plasma. This quark-gluon plasma then expands fluid dynamically, hydrodynamically. It hadronizes when the energy density drops below the critical value for hadronization. The hadrons continue to interact with each other through resonance formation until they freeze out and they eventually move into the detector. What we are doing is condensed matter physics with an unusual type of matter, namely one that interacts strongly with each other. And as any other type of matter, this particular type of matter has a complex phase diagram with a number of phase transitions in there that are known and perhaps others that are not yet known. There is a liquid gas phase transition at low temperatures here. There is the transition between hadron resonance gas and quark-gluon plasma at higher temperatures. If you go to low temperature high densities, you can get into a state of color superconductivity. At very low net variant density, the phase transition becomes, as far as we know, a continuous but very rapid crossover transition. And you can explore this phase diagram with heavy ion collisions at of different collision energies. And as you move up in collision energy, you approach more and more the vertical line at zero net baryon density, which is the line that the universe followed as it cools down at the beginning of times. So what is it that we knew about this phase transition before the heavy ion collisions at RIC started? What we knew about it was from first principle calculations in QCD using the lattice QCD approach. And that told us that there is this rapid crossover phase transition at a temperature of about 173 MeV, at which the number of effective degrees of freedom changes by about an order of magnitude over a small temperature interval. The corresponding critical energy density is about that of the rest mass of a proton inside a cube of one cubic Fermi. Very quickly above that phase transition, the energy density, when you normalize it to T to the fourth, so that you can extract the effective number of masses degrees of freedom, that energy density, that normalized energy density saturates, and it saturates at a level which is about 15 to 20% lower than what you would expect from a radiation gas of non-interacting quarks and gluons. Based on that knowledge from lattice, people thought that their basic ideas were confirmed, namely that at this phase transition, QCD goes into a color deconfined state above which the interactions are relatively weak. And you can describe that as a weakly interacting gas of quarks and gluons with correction of the order of 15%. And what we have learned from RIC, from the RIC experiments, is that that interpretation was entirely wrong. And that even though this deviation is small, the plasma behaves quite differently collectively. It behaves like a fluid and almost ideal fluid at that. So what are the goals of the program? What are the questions that drive this entire program? Well, the first one is, what is the equation of state of QCD matter? We are not content with having the QCD theorists calculated on the lattice. We really want to have it experimentally confirmed. We want to study experimentally the origin of mass generation in the universe by chiral symmetry breaking. We want to understand the properties of this matter that we are creating. What are the real effective degrees of freedom? That, of course, is a very relevant question after I told you that this idea of weakly interacting gas quarks and gluons isn't verified. What's the viscosity of that plasma? What are its color and heat conductivity? What are its other transport properties? What are the processes if it's really a thermalized quark-gluon plasma and these collisions really last only for a very short time because there is nothing to confine that matter, so everything expands very rapidly. So thermalization has to happen on a very short time scale if you want to have validity of fluid dynamics. So what is the mechanism that drives this thermalization? What's the correct language in non-equilibrium quantum field theory to describe this? What role is played by plasma instabilities? Do you have things like turbulence and dynamics of chaos? And last but not least, what is the mechanism that leads to hadronization of these quarks and gluons, and how is it affected by the presence of a hot and dense medium in these collisions? So how do we hope to get information about these questions? Well, we have to live with what the experiments tell us. And this is a picture of what they are telling us. This is all the charged particles produced in a gold-gold collision projected into the transverse plane. Well, it's not all of them. It's the ones that make it into the star detector. There is, per unit of rapidity, there is about 700 charged particles in here for a central gold-gold collision. And the only thing we know is, well, it's quite a lot. We know the momenta and the masses of all these particles. But we don't know anything about the spatial structure of the source that emitted them, except indirectly by looking at correlations between momenta of two particles using the so-called Hanbury-Brown twist interferometry, which is a tool that allows us to get at the spatial information with femtoscopic accuracy. But it's difficult. So the primary information I have on yields, they are the spectra. This gives us information about the chemical and thermal nature of the medium. From the spectra, we can also extract the collective flow. And in particular, the flow anisotropies will play a big role. And then there are the hard probes that are created at the very beginning of the collision and don't get out of the fireball before they have interacted with the medium. So we can use these as tomographic probes of the medium to understand details about its temperature and density. So I've already told you about the goals of the program. Now, I will try to lead you through some of the key observables that have been made at RIC so far. The first one is very strong collective flow and evidence for almost perfect liquidity of the quark-gluon plasma. I call that the little bang. There has also been a measurement of the QCD phase transition through the chemical analysis of the hadron vortices, which gives a freeze-out temperature, chemical freeze-out temperature of 170 MeV, which agrees with the lattice QCD prediction for the phase transition. And we understand that in terms of statistical hadronization. We have some first evidence for quark confinement through the realization that quark coalescence, the quark coalescence picture under, describes very well quantitatively the spectra and yields of particles produced at intermediate and high peak, high transverse momenta. We have the beginnings of what I call jet emission tomography, in analogy to positron emission tomography, that is looking at the medium modification of half protons and heavy quarks and their thermalization. And I only have time to discuss these two aspects. They are probably the most relevant for the rest of this conference. I will leave it at mentioning these two without any further without further elaboration. But I will try to spend the last 10 minutes on some recent work on generalizing the hydrodynamic framework to viscous relativistic fluids and give you some idea of what we expect viscosity to do to the evolution, dynamical evolution of the quark-gluon plasma. So let me start with the Big Bang, the Little Bang flow. These are unfortunately in different order, and this one takes a lot of time to come up. So the natural language to describe collective flow is hydrodynamics. And hydrodynamics is basically solving the equations for local conservation of energy, momentum, and conserved quantities like barrier number, strangeness, and so on, by making the assumption that the system is locally in thermal equilibrium, so that this local distribution function is a Bose-Einstein or Fermi-Dirac distribution function. That allows you to simplify the structure of the energy momentum tensor into the so-called ideal fluid decomposition. And then when you plug that in, you get the relativistic Euler equations. And in order to close these equations, you need an equation of state, which we use something motivated by lattice, which is a combination of a hadron resonance gas and a quark-gluon plasma and a phase transition in between. So when you write these equations out and you write them down in the local co-moving frame, they take on a very instructive and intuitive form. There are two equations which tell you the time evolution of the local baryon density and energy density. And they are what you expect. They are basically saying, OK, these guys decrease by something that's given by the expansion rate. U is the flow velocity field of the fluid. And so this is the divergence of the flow, which describes you how fast the system is expanding. So baryon density and energy density dilute by expansion, no surprise there. But the expansion is controlled by the hydrodynamic version of Newton's law. Acceleration is force divided by mass. The role of force is given by the pressure gradients in the system. The role of mass is given by the energy density plus pressure. And you can rewrite that into a form, which I forgot to write down, which involves only the normalized pressure gradient over the pressure, times a function that involves only the speed of sound. Speed of sound is given as is defined as the derivative of pressure with respect to energy density. And so this tells you that driving force for the collective motion is the speed of sound. So the speed of sound and the history of the speed of sound through the evolution is what controls how much flow is being generated in these conditions, how stiff the matter is. And the speed of sound is something that, of course, you can extract from the lattice data that I showed you earlier. Here is here the results are shown. And you see that about above about twice TC, you have the same speed of sound as in a non-interacting radiation gas. But as you approach TC, it drops very rapidly by about almost a factor of 10. Lattice data become too noisy at low temperatures to go further here, so you have to supplement that information with phonological information for lower density. So the Hadron resonance gas is a very well-tested model of that lower energy region from which you get speed of sound behavior like that. It goes to about maximum half of that in the ideal gas before dropping near the phase transition, and actually should have a dip right here near the phase transition. So this is what we are trying to get at by looking at collective motion in heavy ion collisions. We'd like to confirm this behavior of the speed of sound as the system goes from high temperature to low temperature, eventually freezes out. So a particular good tool to study this at the behavior of the speed of sound at early times is what is called elliptic flow. And that's something that happens in non-central collisions, which are the most abundant ones, where the two nuclei don't completely overlap in the collision, but they overlap only partially, leaving an interaction zone which is spatially deformed. And so now when you think about this thing thermalizing, you have high pressure in the center, zero pressure outside. The pressure gradients in this short direction are steeper than in the long direction. The pressure gradient drives the flow, so you get more flow into the reaction plane than out of the reaction plane. That's called elliptic flow. And that is visible in momentum anisotropies of the finally observed hadrons, but it's being generated in the early stages of the collision when you have that spatial deformation. The spatial deformation goes away as the system expands more rapidly into the reaction plane than out of the reaction plane. So the driving force for generating momentum anisotropy shuts itself off after a while. And so this is a window that particularly focuses on the early stage. You quantify the effect of elliptic flow by something called the elliptic flow coefficient V2. It's basically the cosine 2 phi average of the finally observed Hadron spectrum. And so it's the quadrupole deformation of the finally observed momentum distribution, and it's defined in such a way that it's positive if the system flows into the reaction plane. It would be negative if it were flowing preferentially out of the reaction plane. Now, if my computer ever wakes up, we get to the next picture, which is very colorful but has lots of bytes. Any questions?
Such class. Sometimes I have read that freedot temperatures when you get to thermal yields and rigidity are something like 10% below the heavy.
Okay. So let me just answer that quickly because it addresses a side point that I will not come back to. The extraction of temperature from the experimental yields is subject to theoretical uncertainties, which have to do what spectrum exactly you include in the Hadron resonance gas. And these uncertainties are of the order of about 10 to 15 MeV. So I would think that 10 MeV below the phase transition temperature is not something that gets me worried at the moment. If it was 30 MeV, it would get me worried. So recent lattice results pushed the phase transition temperature up to 190 MeV. The extracted temperatures may be only 160. That 30 MeV difference, that is uncomfortably large. But then I was calmed down by hearing from other lattice groups that they disagree with that 190 MeV extrapolation, and they get 170 MeV. So there is an issue still on the lattice side as to what exactly the freeze-out temperature, the phase transition temperature is, and it has to do with the extrapolation of the lattice data to the continuum, which requires doing the calculation from large lattices, which is very expensive, and it's only happening now. So we'll see that clarified within the next year, but that's the situation. Okay, so you use hydrodynamics to describe that dynamical evolution, and here is something that you can get out from such a calculation. You start the system with an initial geometric model for the overlap, which has this out-of-plane deformation, and then you watch it as it evolves in time, and you see that it evolves more rapidly into the reaction plane after about 8 Fermis after the beginning. It's become more or less undeformed, and then if hydrodynamics continues to work even after that time, it would start to evolve out of into the reaction plane. It would get a deformation that's opposite to the initial deformation. And this is what you get out of such a model. You have to fit a few parameters. I will get back to that in the next slide, which you do by looking at pion and proton spectra in completely central conditions, or as completely central as you can make them experimentally. And then you just calculate things for all other particles in central conditions and in peripheral conditions without adjusting any more parameters. And this is the kind of quality of descriptions that you get. Pions, protons, kaons, and lots of other hadrons have been compared, and everything looks qualitatively on this level, which I would say is a pretty good description, especially if you realize that this is on a log plot, so that means that once you get out there where things start to break down, you are in the region where you have to deal with less than 1% of the particles. As I said, everything for non-central conditions is a parameter-free prediction. So one of the predictions is the elliptic flow coefficient as a function of collision centrality. Collision centrality is measured by the number of charged particles coming out. So the most central collisions are out here. The most peripheral collisions are out here. This, in central collisions, of course, you have no deformation, so you don't get elliptic flow. In very peripheral collisions, you have very largely deformed source. Expect to get a lot of elliptic flow. And this is the prediction from hydrodynamics, ideal hydrodynamics, which was expected to be an upper limit. And the experiments came in as shown here. And you see for central to semi-central collisions, they are completely exhaust the upper limit from ideal hydrodynamics. Even better than that, when you look at the elliptic flow as a function of the transverse momentum of the particles, now this is for all charged hadrons, and you look at the hadron, at the hydrodynamic predictions and the data, you see that out to about 1.5 to 2 GeV, you have a perfect description. And as I said before, this involves 99% of the particles. Now, before I go on, let me quickly say a couple of words about the procedure. Of course, hydrodynamics is not a model that describes the entire prediction. The system first has to thermalize, and at the moment we don't have a complete complete dynamical theory of that thermalization process, so this is replaced by initial conditions in the hydrodynamics which have to be adjusted. And then at the end, when the system becomes too dilute, scattering becomes rare, and therefore the system cannot maintain local thermal equilibrium, so again hydrodynamics starts to break down at the end. And for that we have a so-called freeze-out criterion, which stops the hydrodynamic stage. And so we have to fix these initial and final conditions, and as I said, they are being fixed in central conditions by looking at particle spectra with two different masses, because different mass particles react to thermal motion and to collective motion differently, and so you can separate the freeze-out temperature from the collective flow, and then you can ask yourself how much time do you need for the flow to develop. That gives you some upper limit for the time at which you have to start the hydrodynamics, and then the final multiplicity counts the total entropy in the system. Since hydrodynamics, ideal hydrodynamics, conserves entropy, you know what the initial entropy is. So if you so you can figure out the initial entropy density in the center from a geometric model. So this was, in a nutshell, what's written on this lengthy transparency. But I want to stress that all of this is done for central collisions. And then you go and calculate things in peripheral collisions just by using a Clauber model for the overlap geometry, and then plugging the same things into the hydrodynamics and calculating it. I want to stress that the initial energy densities that you get from there, the initial thermalization times are short. So you have to start hydro at something less than 1 Fermi over C. The corresponding energy densities are high. They are at least a factor of 10 to 20 above the value where we expect colony confinement. The lifetime of the plasma state is reasonably long. It takes about 5 to 7 Fermis before it starts, before it completely hydrodynamizes. And the radial flow, the flow transverse to the beam direction, which we call radial flow, is large. It's more than half the speed of light. So now let's look at this elliptic flow in even more detail. Hydrodynamics says that the local distribution function is a boosted thermal equilibrium distribution function, which is boosted locally by the flow of fluid. And so this flow has a mass-dependent effect on the particle spectra, and therefore the elliptic flow coefficient depends on the Hadron line. And so here are the lines, the calculated lines from hydrodynamics for particles with different masses as indicated here, and there are the corresponding data. And again, you see up to about 1.5 GeV, maybe 2 GeV, you get a perfect reproduction of that mass splitting, that hydrodynamically predicted mass splitting, so-called fine structure of the elliptic flow. And only once you get into the tails, you see breakdown. You also see that the breakdown is different for mesons than for baryons. Baryons follow the hydro higher than mesons. That's an entire story in itself, has to do with the spore coalescence, which I will not talk any more about here in this talk today. But the thing that I want to get across is that this is 99% of the particles, and for those 99% of the particles, of low momentum particles, hydro provides a perfect description. And this is significant because the description only works reasonably well, the mass splitting comes out reasonably well if you take the phase transition into account in your equation of state. If you eliminate the phase transition by just replacing the equation of state, say, by a Hadron resonance gas, which goes on forever, you get a mass splitting that's only half as big and doesn't describe the data nearly as well as the one with the phase transition. That's not to say that we have proven phase transition by the data. I don't think the accuracy of that analysis is good enough to do that at this point. But okay, I have to speed up. Okay, what does this mean? Well, this has very important implications, which I think is most easily pointed out by looking at a completely different area of physics, namely very, very low temperatures, the other extreme of the temperature scale. Cold atoms trapped in an elliptically deformed trap and then let go. And the nice thing about that those experiments is that you can dial the strength of the interactions between the atoms by using what's called a Fischbach resonance. If you go on resonance, they interact strongly, and then this is what you see. And you see exactly what I told you hydrodynamics will give you. You see the system expands more rapidly into the reaction plane, becomes spherically, eventually goes in plane extended. And here, and this is actually photographs taken of these cold atom ellipses, which is something we cannot do because we don't have direct spatial information about the source. But those guys can do it, they can take photographs, and they see that this happens. And this happens when they put the system on the resonance so that the atoms interact strongly. Then they go off resonance and they make the atoms interact weakly, and then this phenomenon disappears completely. Instead, you get ballistic expansion and the system becomes spherical, big and spherical after a while. So the elliptic flow is evidence for strong interactions in the medium, and you can also back that up theoretically by trying to describe the quark-gluon plasma phase through a cascade with binary collisions and cross-sections involved, and then you see that as for small cross-sections, you don't get any elliptic flow at all. As you increase the cross-sections, you get the elliptic flow. More cross-section means more scattering, means more elliptic flow. You have to go to pretty large cross-sections to exhaust the hydrodynamic limit. These cross-sections that go through the data are about a factor of 5 to 10 bigger than were previously estimated based on perturbative QCD estimates. So this is evidence for very strong interactions in the plasma in order to reproduce that flow. You can reformulate that in terms of a different language, namely corrections to ideal hydrodynamics through transport coefficients. Shear viscosity is one of the transport effects. And here's an attempt by Derek Cheney a few years ago after his thesis to limit the amount of shear viscosity that you can allow that is allowed by possible differences between the hydrodynamic prediction and the experimental data. And so he did a very simple analysis where he parametrized the data with a simple blast wave model, so it's not a full hydrodynamics, and then took into account that in the final state, if the system is viscous, the spectra should have a viscous contribution. They should deviate from Bose-Einstein by an amount which is proportional to the shear viscosity over the entropy density times the temperature. And he could limit that quantity by just looking at how quickly he goes away from the data to be less than the so-called sound attenuation length, to be less than 0.1. And if you translate that into an entropy over into a shear viscosity over entropy ratio, it's in the ballpark of a of h bar of 4 pi, which is a conjectured lower limit for the shear viscosity based on string motivated work by Damson and collaborators a few years ago.
Let me ask you a question here.
Yep.
For the pk less than 1 GeV there, there was really even large deviation for zero viscosity. So
oh, this, like yeah, no, this is because, no, this is not, as I said, this is not a full hydrodynamic simulation. It's a very simple blast wave model to go roughly through the data. It's not a fit to the data. And so this is not a feature of the model, or this
so
is
how the limit.
By just looking at how quickly things go away at high PTs. This is, I will come back to that. This is a very rough estimate in the following sense. Because it assumes ideal fluid, it assumes thermal equilibrium until the end, because that's the essence of the blast wave model. But then it says, okay, if it were not thermal equilibrium, what would be the correction to the spectra? It does not take into account any viscous effects onto the dynamical evolution. For that, you need a viscous hydrodynamic evolution, which we have now, but which he didn't have then. Yes.
I think a way to answer your first question is to say that the only mistake Derek made was to plot his curves and the data on the same plot. And that the way to read them, think of them as two separate plots.
The mistake was that he didn't use his own hydro.
Okay.
Then it would work.
But let me finish. Yeah. Think of them as two separate plots. What you're supposed to do is look at the difference between the theory curves. That gives you a sense of the size of the viscous effect. And compare that difference to the magnitude of the V2 in the data.
Yes.
So think of them as two side-by-side plots. One showing how much V2 is for a data, and how well that, which you showed before, how well that agrees with ideal hydro. And then the thing of the theory plots in isolation as giving you a sense of the magnitude of viscous effects.
Yes. Now let me tell you why we did that, why he didn't use his own hydro to do a proper fit. To calculate the viscous corrections, you need to have the velocity gradient. And that's easy to calculate in a model, and it's very hard to extract from a real hydrodynamic calculation.
What do you think there?
Eric is there.
Whatever you meant to do, what Patricia said or what Edward said, either would have been good.
Okay. So, all right, so let's come back here. So this is a plot of eta over s, or actually eta over s divided by this purported lower limit. For a number of systems that are known, helium gas, nitrogen, helium goes all the way to its phase transition to liquidity. And you see all of these guys have viscosities which are orders of magnitude above the limit that is this lower bound. And so if Derek is right, and the quark-gluon plasma is within a factor of 2 to 3 of that lower limit, this makes the quark-gluon plasma the most perfect liquid ever observed in the lab. Now, I told you about how ideal hydrodynamics is successful in describing the data, but it also has limitations. And I want to argue that most of these limitations come from the fact that the system at the end goes into a hadronic phase, and that the hadronic phase is not ideal at all. It's a very viscous liquid. And the evidence for that comes from various corners. It was very quickly pointed out that hydro works only in the most central conditions at the top energies. But when you go to either peripheral conditions, we saw that already earlier, or you go to lower energies, the measured elliptic flow coefficient lags increasingly below, stays increasingly below what hydrodynamics predicted, actually has the wrong tendency with energy. This drops because of effects from the phase transition between the AGS accelerator and the RIC accelerator, whereas the data have a continuous increase. And the other corner where things break down is in away from mid-rapidity, even at the highest RIC energies. When you don't look at things at mid-rapidity, but you look at forward rapidity, hydrodynamics predicts a completely different shape of the V2 as a function of rapidity, and forward rapidity is overpredicts it by a considerable fraction.
So in this hydro matching, some of the shear viscosities have been taken into account?
No viscosity has been taken into account. All of that is ideal, yeah? The only place I have talked about shear viscosity semi-quantitatively was in the previous plot, and as I said, this was not based on a viscous hydrodynamics approach. This was based on a perturbative analysis of the final state using viscous hydrodynamics ideas. So what's common to both of these things is that as you move away from RIC energies to lower energies, or away from mid-rapidity to forward rapidities, the multiplicity density decreases. And the multiplicity density is a measure for initial entropy density, so the initial entropy density decreases. And that, if, that means that you start from lower initial entropy densities, which means you get to, you cool down to the phase transition more quickly because you don't start as high up. And therefore, more of the dynamical evolution goes, happens in the late hadronic phase. So Derek Tini was the first to point out that this, in fact, can explain the behavior of the elliptic flow in peripheral conditions at Rick energies, where hydrodynamics predicts it to go up and come down, whereas the data, okay, here's the data, here go down. The data shown in previous is rather better. And his cascade, his model, which is a was a hybrid model, which used hydrodynamics only for the 4-coulomb plasma phase, but switched to a realistic hadron cascade after hadronization, was able to get this right. This was bad news because ideal hydrodynamics predicts a nice phase transition signature on the elliptic flow, which is completely cut off by this non-ideal behavior of the hadronic phase. Last year, Tetsu Hirano and I and some others elaborated on that work further by making it three-dimensional. So first, we confirmed what Derek had seen already earlier, that if you replace the ideal fluid approach by a fluid for the Borkmann plasma, but then hadronic cascade approach, that this reduces the elliptic flow mostly in peripheral collisions and therefore brings the theory better in alignment with data than the purely pure hydrodynamic approach. What it also showed is that this is very sensitive to whether we have the right model for the initial geometry. And what we have used all these years was a Glauber model, and we are still using it, but then people came along, said, okay, we have initially a dense gluonic system, a colored glass condensate, and based on these ideas, models were developed to describe the geometrical distribution of multiplicity in that model. That's called the Kazeyev-Levy-Nadi model. And so if you take that particular model, it's not a theory, it's a model parameterization of the of ideas based on the colored glass condensate. You find that the initial deformation is actually bigger. It's more deformed than expected from the Glauber model. And then, of course, the hydrodynamics translates that larger initial spatial eccentricity into a larger final elliptic flow. And now you see that pure hydrodynamics all the way to freeze out is completely off the data. But even when you include the effect from hadronic, the viscous effect from hadronic rescattering, you don't get down to the data anymore. So if the color glass KLN model were the right model, then you would have evidence that you need viscous corrections even for the quark gluon plasma evolution. So how do we resolve this? Well, we need better control over the initial conditions. There is significant uncertainty on the theoretical side. Here is a recent calculation by Luppi and Vinogopalan, also based on the colored glass condensate ideas, but trying to extract this from a dynamical evolution of the gluon fields, get at the eccentricity. And instead of the KLN eccentricity, which is 30% larger than the Glauber model, they get something which is consistent with the Glauber model in the binary collision approach, which would basically get rid of this problem completely. So we have to work better on theoretical approaches, but we should perhaps also try to see whether we can get experimentally at the very, very early stage, and we need to get at the spatial structure of the very, very early stage, and that requires two-particle interferometry with photons, which is very, very hard, but we are working on it. Anyway, so let me return to the KLM, to the Glauber model. So here is now a study of the elliptic flow as a function of rapidity. As I told you earlier, hydrodynamics gives the wrong shape relative to the data. Here are three curves, or two curves and a set of points. The green curve is what you get in terms of elliptic flow just from the quark gluon plasma evolution. And you see that's not enough to explain the data. So if you stopped hydrodynamics right at the phase transition and nothing else happened afterwards, you would not get enough elliptic flow. On the other hand, if you continue ideal fluid dynamics into the hadronic phase until final kinetic decoupling, you get too much elliptic flow. You overshoot the data, in particular in the forward and backward regions. And by hybridizing the the ideal fluid approach in the quarkuon plasma with a hadronic, realistic hadronic rescattering approach in the final hadronic stage. You just get enough elliptic flow over the entire rapidity region to describe the data. So hadronic viscosity is very important, and it has a chance of explaining most or even all of the discrepancies between the pure ideal fluid dynamical approach and the experimental data. So as I said, we want to get better access to the early stage. For that, you have to use something that comes out from the early stage directly, photons and dileptons, which reinteract only electromagnetically, which means they don't in this small system. They are the ideal probe. And this is just to give you an idea that there is quite some interesting structure that you can see there. As I showed you, hadronic elliptic flow as a function of PT is this monotonically rising function. For direct photons, you get something that first rises and then drops. And this is a reflection that the high PT photons are emitted from the early hot stage, where you don't have the elliptic flows developed yet. And so by going from high PT to low PT, you can basically see the elliptic flow evolve as a function of time. If you do it for dileptons, there is even more structure in there because you have these resonances, these hadronic resonances. Whenever you have dileptons coming from a hadronic resonance, you are basically dominated by the hadronic phase, and the elliptic flow approaches that of the hadronic phase, whereas away from these resonances, you're close to the early quark matter phase, which has less elliptic flow. Well, this is for the future. Let me now come to the other aspect of heavy ion collisions, namely, can we back up this picture that I extracted from the collective flow feature by other observers? And in particular, can we find out something about what causes this rapid thermalization? So I'm going to use these non-thermal half partons as a tomographic probe to get a little bit of an idea of what's happening here. So the idea is there that in the initial collisions, you form these high PT jets, which then have to propagate through this medium, which forms afterwards, but shortly afterwards, in a time scale of less than one fermi over C, whereas it takes about 5 to 6 fermis over C for these partons to move out. So they have quite some time to move through this medium, and that has an effect. The immediate effect is if you look at at particle production at high PT in nucleus-nucleus collisions, and you normalize it by what you expect from a superposition of proton-proton collisions, you find a suppression by a factor of 5. And this suppression is seen in hadrons, in particular here in pi zeros and eta's from the Phoenix collaboration, but it's not seen in photons. So photons are produced and they get out without reinteraction. Pions only get out after the jet has moved through the medium and hadronizes, and the jet loses energy and the high PT particle production is suppressed. Photons are not affected. Also, when you do the control experiment in deuteron-gold collisions, you don't see the suppression there. So it's clearly a final state interaction effect. The suppression is clearly a final state interaction effect of the medium onto the hard particle. And you can parameterize that by assuming that this energy loss is radiative and do a perturbative calculation, which is parameterized in terms of perturbative QCD cross-section and a multiplicity density of gluons. And you fit that to the data. Dulashi and Levine collaborators did that. They found this number for the number of gluons, and the corresponding energy density extracted from there is in the same ballpark as the one that you extract from hydrodynamics. And it's a completely independent estimate, and it's completely consistent. So what can we learn from this jet tomography? Now we get into the puzzles. As I said, this was a fit based on perturbative QCD, and people have since then tried to refine these fits. And so the original idea is due to Gürken, who thought it was collisional energy loss. Then Dulashi found out that radiative dominates, in particular for non-abelian theories. Then there's a long history of papers that works out this radiative energy loss and found in the end that there is a relatively easy parameterization of the entire effect in terms of the so-called momentum loss transport coefficient, which is given by the screening length in the medium. That's a measure of the density of particles divided by the cross-section, which is divided by the mean free path, which is a measure of the cross-section. And in the perturbative approach, this transport coefficient is proportional to 3/4 power of the energy density, which is shown here. And then you try to fit this a suppression effect by such a model with this as a free parameter. And this is an analysis by Wiedemann, Escolar, and collaborators. And you get something of the order of 5 to 15 GeV squared per Fermi for this transport coefficient. Well, let me warn you, this is a very simple approach which basically caricatures the expansion by a very simple model. So this is not a real hydrodynamic model as a background. So it has certain uncertainties, but given that, it's still bothersome that what you extract here, this 10 to 15, seems to lie about a factor of 5 above what this perturbative approach gives you. So that's another hint that indicates that there is strong, maybe much stronger coupling involved than we thought. It gets worse when you look at heavy quark energy loss, and you can trace heavy quarks like charm and Purie quarks through their electronic decays by looking at the electrons. And then you look at their suppression, you find that it's much bigger than you can get from radiative energy loss at all, alone. And so people started to bring back collisional energy loss, which was originally argued to be subdominant, and realized that with strict parameters, it's actually not that small. And then Magdalena Georgievic and collaborators worked out that it's actually almost as big as the radiative energy loss for RIC. You still don't make it quite to the data. You get an improvement, but of course you have to refit the pion data, and in the end, you don't quite make it there. You make it in the right direction, but you don't quite make it there. So the perturbative approach is kind of shaky. Okay, so side remark, how would you separate elastic from inelastic collision energy loss? Well, they have different path length dependencies. Elastic is always linear in the path length, whereas radiative energy loss is quadratic in the path length if the quark is light or the jet that the initial parton is very, very energetic. And you can do that in a controlled fashion by taking uranium collisions, which have a deformed overlap region, and then looking at the energy loss of different regions so that you control the path length without changing the energy density. That's something that is part of the RIC2 experimental program. Now, the last point I want to make, we recently discovered that the existing calculations of radiative energy loss may be underestimating the radiative energy loss by almost a factor of 2, because they model the medium by a system of static scatterers and don't allow recoil of the scatterers. And if you do it correctly, which we have been able to do in lowest order, so this is not a complete calculation and you shouldn't compare it directly to experiments because it misses coherent effects like LPM suppression, higher order collisions, and finite size corrections. But with all these caveats, the lowest order in a dynamical medium is a factor of 2 bigger the energy loss than previously calculated, which goes in the right direction, and it may help to save sort of the perturbative approach, QCD approach to energy loss. So you should all keep that in mind before you jump to the conclusion that you have to do this with ADS CFT. Or what I also want to get across, we have a very high level of quantitative detail in the perturbative approach, and we need, of course, eventually to get to a similar level of quantitative detail from the ADS CFT approach if we want to see whether one or the other works better. What happens to this energy that's lost by the heavy quarks as it moves through the particles? Well, what you see is when you look at high PT particles and you trigger on a particle coming out with high PT in one direction, and then you look at high PT particles elsewhere, you see usually in proton-proton collisions, you see a peak at 180 degrees because the jets were produced, protons were produced in pairs. And that's shown here, trigger peak, peak at 180 degrees in proton-proton, still present in deuteron gold, gone in central gold-gold. So no high PT particles on the other side of a central gold-gold collision. The high PT particles have vanished, but they haven't gone. Their energy hasn't gone completely. You see it as a peak in low energy particle production at 180 degrees, a very broad peak, which even seems to have some structure. So this tells you two things. It tells you that the energy loss is really not. It's not a loss of energy, it's a degradation of the energy of the heavy parton, and it gets redistributed into additional particles at low momentum, which is what you would expect a relevant mechanism for thermalizing the momentum of these high PT particles. The other thing that you learn is that maybe there is structure in the way these low PT particles are emitted. And Edward Shuyak and collaborators and Paul Stöcker had the idea that maybe this is another evidence for the ideal fluid dynamical behavior of the medium. The energy is fed into the medium. It's deposited by the fast particle at the speed of light. It can evolve, the additional energy dumped into the medium can evolve only with the speed of sound, and therefore you get a Mach cone. And so you should expect preferential emission of particles perpendicular to the Mach cone, which is not at 180 degrees to the trigger, but at a finite angle, and that finite angle would be sensitive to the speed of sound relative to the speed of light. And this is, at least superficially, supported by experimental evidence. Here is a nice plot from Phoenix, which shows if you have a trigger particle observed in this direction, what is the distribution of low PT particles in the opposite direction, in the opposite hemisphere. And when you have peripheral collisions, you have a peak at 180 degrees. But as you go from peripheral to more central collisions, you see that the peak at 180 degrees disappears, and instead you get a peak, or somewhat of a peak in sideways directions, which is exactly this kind of idea. But then you try to model it hydrodynamically, and, well, you see that if with a realistic energy loss, it's hard to see some things, but if you check up the energy loss by a factor of 10 above what is phenomenologically allowed, then you can clearly see these Mach cones develop. But then you look at it and how it manifests itself in emitted particle spectra, and you get a distribution which doesn't fit the data at all. If there are structures and peaks in there that are in the wrong hemisphere, they are closer to 0 degrees, which is the direction of the trigger, than to 180 degrees, not here where the mass cones are expected. And so we see more of this backsplash stuff here rather than the preferential emission there. So at the moment, we don't know how to what really produces the structure in the data and whether this idea of Mach cones is correct. Maybe we've fed the energy not correctly into the fluid. That's something for the future. Okay, let me spend 5 minutes on relativistic fluid dynamics. This is, of course, an absolute must to develop a formalism like that if you want to get at the viscosity, the shear viscosity, and other transport coefficients of the quark-gluon plasma in a phenomenological fashion. If you want to do a really honest job of extracting viscosity from data, not the perturbative approach that was pioneered by Derek, but a real honest job, you have to have a viscous hydrodynamic language where you can use viscosity as a parameter that you can adjust to the data. So again, you start from energy moment conservation, but now because you have to give up the idea of complete local thermal equilibration, you have to add additional terms to the energy momentum tensor, which are called viscous pressure corrections. I will neglect bulk viscosity and heat conductivity, only include shear viscosity, so you have a so-called traceless and symmetric viscous pressure tensor. And what you really need to do in order to preserve causality of the dynamic formulation is to treat this viscous pressure tensor as an additional dynamical degree of freedom, which evolves by a relaxation equation towards twice times the viscosity times the velocity gradient, the so-called velocity shear tensor. If you identify these two directly, you get something what is called Navier-Stokes, and that is non-relativistically okay, but relativistically it's acausal because it has instantaneous signal propagation. So you have to replace that by a kinetic framework which introduces a short but finite kinetic relaxation timescale. And both the viscosity and the kinetic relaxation timescale should in principle be calculable from an underlying kinetic approach to the quark-gluon plasma. But we don't have that because the quark-gluon plasma is presumably strongly coupled. And so anything we have is perturbative and doesn't give reliable estimates for these at this point. So we consider these as phenomenological parameters which we play around with within a certain domain of validity. For example, the entire viscous hydrodynamic approach is only valid if the relaxation time scale, the kinetic relaxation time scale, is faster than the expansion time scale. And so what you get is a more complicated framework, which in addition to the hydrodynamic equations has now evolution equations for these viscous pressure tensors in one plus one dimensional approach, where you have longitudinal boost invariant expansion, one radial dynamical expansion, and one time dimension. So this is good for central collision, zero impact parameter. This is the set of equations. If you want to get an elliptic flow, you have to do at least 2 plus 1 dimensional. And the set of equations is more complicated, so I didn't write it down, but you can read it up. Let me just illustrate qualitatively what's going on. You see that already from the 1 plus 1 decays. You get these corrections to the driving forces in the energy momentum tensor. This is the one that is responsible for longitudinal, for cooling of the system by a longitudinal expansion. It's corrected by this pi eta eta, which turns out to be negative because theta, the expansion rate, is 1 over tau. So you get 1 over third tau minus initially 1 over tau. So this is negative initially when the system is mostly longitudinally expanding. And so you get a reduction of the longitudinal pressure, reduction of the work done to longitudinal expansion, and therefore a reduction of the rate at which the system cools down. On the other hand, the transverse, this describes transverse evolution. The transverse pressure increase is increased because this term turns out to be positive. So the system cools down more slowly longitudinally. It expands more rapidly in the transverse direction. And you see that in the cooling curve. This is a somewhat rich diagram, so let me try to lead you through there. It's also hardly visible here. So there is a light blue curve, which is basically ideal hydro in one-dimensional pure K, no transverse expansion at all. And that has a very well-known one over tau behavior of the temperature until you hit the phase transition. Then you stay at that temperature for a long time, and then eventually you cool down outside the range of this diagram. You include viscosity, but don't allow for transverse expansion. You see that the system cools down more slowly. You take the ideal, you include transverse expansion in the 1 plus 1 dimensional approach. The system cools down more rapidly because of the additional transverse expansion. You include viscosity. The system doesn't cool down quite as rapidly as in the ideal 1 plus 1, but more rapidly than in the simple longitudinal expansion. So initially, it cools, the cooling is decelerated by this effect of reduced longitudinal pressure. But then, look what happens. Here it crosses over, and eventually it cools more rapidly than the ideal fluid. Why? Well, because of the transverse flow that has developed, which is stronger, and therefore you get more strong three-dimensional expansion, and the system eventually cools more rapidly than in the ideal case. And here we show that, indeed, this is the transition from one-dimensional longitudinal expansion to three-dimensional expansion in the late stages. You see that for viscous hydrodynamics, this crossover happens earlier than for the ideal hydrodynamics. And eventually, the system expands more rapidly in the viscous case. This was previously seen by other people, although not clearly pointed out. But now we have very clear evidence for that to happen, and we know exactly what's driving that. I cannot show that here in the short time. This just shows you that the radial flow indeed develops more rapidly and is bigger in the viscous approach. And so for the same initial conditions, you get flatter spectra. The dashed line gets you just the flattening from the additional radial flow. And the dashed line gives you the additional effects from the fact that at the late stage, the system is not in complete thermal equilibrium, so you have viscous corrections to the shape of the spectra. This is not an attempt to fit the data. This is just to tell you, to show you what the effects are.
What is the magnitude of viscosity?
I'm sorry?
What is the magnitude of the viscosity?
Okay. Magnitude of the viscosity is the minimum. So it's the smallest that we would dare to take. And keep that in mind for a minute. So anisotropies, now for that you need a 2 plus 1 dimensional code. And I think this is the first time you will see presentations of results from a 2 dimensional one, from a 2 plus 1 dimensional viscous code. This shows you that the evolution of the anisotropies, this is the difference of the velocity, the flow in x direction versus y direction, should be the magnitude of that. You see that compared to the ideal fluid case, this anisotropy develops more quickly, but then it stalls earlier. And this is actually where the phase transition, this is copper-copper, we can do only copper-copper at the moment because our grid is too small. We can't, it cannot accommodate lead on lead. It will do so in a few weeks, I hope. So phase transition is reached already here, two fermions over sea, and then this turns over. But it turns over earlier and at a lower level than for the ideal case, and you can see why that is from the driving force. Let me not get into that. As a result, look at the evolution of the spatial deformation of the fireball. The blue curve is what we had earlier from ideal fluid dynamics. With the viscous dynamics, it actually undeforms more quickly initially, and only later the undeformation slows down. And here is the momentum anisotropy from the ideal fluids. This is due to the phase transition, a structure that's well known from earlier calculations. This is the ideal fluid. This is the viscous fluid. If you take into account only the ideal parts of the energy momentum tensor in the viscous fluid, you get this. So this difference between these two red lines is the contribution from the viscous pressure tensor to the momentum anisotropy, and you see it's huge. It's a big effect, and towards the end of the collision, these viscous effects become weaker, but the net result is that throughout the evolution, the momentum anisotropy, even with that small shear viscosity of 1 over 4 pi, is reduced by almost a factor of 2, and of course you can see that in the elliptic flow. Here is the elliptic flow for pions, kaons, and protons, ideal hydrodynamics, viscous hydrodynamics. And this is the contribution from here to here. This is the contribution because the hydrodynamic evolution generates less velocity anisotropy. This additional effect is what Derek calculated in this earlier work. This is the contribution from the fact that the spectrum is not Bose-Einstein, but it has viscous corrections to Bose-Einstein. That's this effect. The other effect is as big or even bigger than this initial one. And that's just with a minimal viscosity. The data are not anywhere close to there. I have no idea what this means at this moment. This is a week old, so we'll have to sort out what this means.
Do you know anything about the sensitivity to your relaxation time?
Not yet. Not at this point. This is, you have to run and run and run and run, and it's one PhD student doing it at the moment. OK, I have to skip over that because my time is over, yeah, I know. But it's an idea which I don't think gets fair representation in this meeting. So let me just quickly mention it. We'll have a lot of discussion whether we need whether QCD perturbation theory is excluded by these data or not, and whether we need an entirely different approach like strong coupling ACLS CFT. Here is an idea of possibly saving the perturbative QCD approach to thermalization by invoking something that's called anomalous viscosity. And the idea is really simple when you boil it down to the essentials. If you have an anisotropically expanding fluid and you have finite viscosity, so it's not an ideal fluid, then the anisotropies in the expansion rate lead to local anisotropies in the momentum distribution due to viscous effects, due to the deviations from the ideal Bose-Einstein distribution, which is of course always locally isotropic. So in a viscous fluid, you have deviations from local isotropy. And once you have deviations from local momentum anisotropy, you can have plasma instability. And that goes back to the late 50s, but has really exploded into a lot of activity in the last 3-4 years by several different groups. And we will hear about that. But if you have plasma instabilities, in a usual electrodynamic plasma, it's known that this can lead to turbulent magnetic fields. In our case, these would be turbulent color magnetic fields, and those turbulent fields lead to anomalous viscosity. So anomalous energy momentum transport and anomalous energy loss. And this anomalous viscosity decreases with the magnitude of these magnetic fields, and the magnitude of these magnetic fields is proportional to the magnitude of the original shear viscosity that we have in the system. So in the end, both of these viscosities combine with inverses because the scattering rates add, and so you end up with a total viscosity, which is the smaller of the two. And so if this anomalous viscosity gets small, it can dominate, and in particular in the weak coupling limit, that is the case. because the anomalous viscosity scales like 1 over g to the 3 halves, whereas the conditional viscosity scales like 1 over g to the 4th. So for g small, the anomalous effect is biggest. And so it could be true that the system we make at RIC is anomalously low in viscosity because of these anisotropy effects and the resulting instabilities, which would not be there in the early universe. And so if this were true, then the quark-gluon plasma would be an almost ideal fluid in Hilbertian conditions, but it would not be an almost ideal fluid in the early universe where you don't have the anomalous viscosity. So I want to just throw this out and close by summarizing. Okay, so the elliptic flow is the key observable that tells us that we have short thermalization times at RIC and initial energy densities that are at least an order of magnitude above the phase transition, initial temperature twice Tc, long lifetime of the plasma before it carbonizes. First time quark-gluon plasma really manifests itself in experimental observations. And this quark-gluon plasma seems to be close to an ideal fluid. It then has to be a strongly coupled plasma. Doesn't mean it has to be non-perturbative. You could have strong couplings through other mechanisms that are consistent with perturbation theory, but it's certainly a strongly coupled plasma in the way plasma physicists define that, as behaving as a liquid. Other RIC data support this picture. I have mentioned them in the introduction. In particular, we get an independent measure of the energy density from jet emission tomography, and that also tells us that this plasma is very opaque to colored sources. How perfect is this quark-gluon plasma liquid? Well, this is something that is probably the main subject of this conference. It will also have in the future a phenomenological component, which is based on relativistic hydrodynamics for viscous fluids, which is now happening. And so I think it will soon be extracted from logically from the data at RIC and LHC. Thank you.
A couple of questions. One is about this cross section. You mentioned that you need to increase this to 485 millibar, right? So I wonder what is a kind of possible interpretation could be for this increased cross section. And the other question is that a different area. It's when you're talking about this color glass comparison that it gives you a overshoot as compared. Does it show that in some way color glass model is not sufficient?
Okay, let me get to the first question first. So these cross-section numbers that I showed you there are token numbers which assume that the system is dominated by binary collisions. Of course, with these large cross-sections, that is not a valid assumption anymore. So it parameterizes all the higher order effects like 2 to 3 scattering. And so you can't take it too seriously. It just tells you that if you want to get phenomenologically to the hydro limit, just assuming two binary collisions, you need huge cross-sections.
But you don't
want to interpret that number directly,
yeah,
because in that sense it's misleading. You don't want to get the binary collision cross section to that value. You want to include all the effects that add up to such a big interaction. But it's clear that it's not a dilute system which is dominated by binary scattering with perturbative cross sections. You can't get to the data in this way. Okay, about the color glass condensate. Well, the eccentricity of the source, which is different from that model, from a global model, is very sensitive to how the density falls off near the edges. And this fall off near the edges is parameterized in the color glass approach, in the KLM approach, by the spatial dependence of the saturation scale. And of course, near the edge where the projected density gets small, the saturation scales get small, and so we get into the area where the model breaks down. So you're sensitive, the calculation of the eccentricity in that model is sensitive to details of the model where it starts to break down. So you have to take this thing with a big grain of salt. However, it's out there, and if it has a core of truth in there, it might mean that what we thought the eccentricity was is not what the real is, and it has huge phenomenological implications on how we interpret the elliptic flow data. So this needs to be clarified theoretically and hopefully also experimentally.
But it means that the bulk of the data is not consistent with it.
It's not consistent with the KLM parameterization of the color class model. It doesn't mean that the color class model is wrong.
Yeah.
It's really exciting to see V2 coming from a relativistic viscous hydro calculation. But just to I mean, if your 1 week old result is correct, even at 1/4 pi, you get this huge drop in V2. Then maybe we need the KLM parameterization of the color glass condensate to have a chance.
Maybe.
It will be very interesting.
We are opening up a new world.
It will be very interesting.
Coming
year
will be very interesting.
In the next weeks with that calculation.
Well, give us a few months.
Back in 20